So today, I want to talk to you about some of the most amazing running moments in history. Some of the most amazing running moments in history. On May 6th, 1954, a crowd gathered at Iffley Road Track outside of Oxford, England to watch Roger Bannister attempt something that had never been done before, to run a sub-4-minute mile. Two friends paced him around the track, and with about a quarter mile to go, he sprinted off alone and he crossed the finish line and he collapsed on the track as the announcer's voice came on the speaker and said, 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds. 2004, I was there when the Tennessee State High School record for cross country was set by Andrew Bumbelow at the steeplechase in Nashville. Andrew was the heavy favorite, and when the gun went off, another kid in the race kind of sprinted out in front of him and turned around to taunt him as if to say, I'm beating Andrew Bumbelow. And then he promptly tripped over his own feet in front of the oncoming rush of high school boys. I'll never forget it. But Andrew Bumbelow finished the 5K in 14 minutes and 14 seconds, over a minute faster than the second place runner. And his record is still 30 seconds faster than the next fastest time recorded in Tennessee. This year at the Tokyo Olympics, the winner of the marathon was a Kenyan by the name of Eliud Kipchoge. Now, a marathon, as you know, is 26.2 miles, and Kipchoge ran that in Tokyo in 2 hours, 8 minutes, and 38 seconds. But that was a slow time for Kipchoge, because in May of 2019, he set out to run a sub-2-hour marathon. So just for comparison, Runner's World did a study of over 100 million marathon results over the past 35 years, and the average time for a marathon was just over 4.5 hours. So Kipchoge set out to more than cut that in half. And in May 2019, on a closed course, he ran a marathon in 1 hour, 59 minutes, and 40 seconds. That's an average of just over 4.5 minute miles for 26 miles. And then, of course, everybody remembers the Vanderbilt Invitational in 2000 at Edwin Warner Park, when the scrappy upstart college cross country team, which included Travis Garner, came to Nashville. And on that day, against all odds, I came in second place to last. Second place to last. But go with me on this. If second place is the first loser, then second to last is the first winner. Second to last is the last winner? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Some of the greatest moments in running history. The Gospel of John also recounts one of the greatest races in history. In John chapter 20, on the very first Easter morning, Mary Magdalene runs to find the disciples because when she went to the tomb on Easter morning to put spices on the body of Jesus, she found that the tomb was empty. And so Peter and John took off running the short distance from where they were staying to the place where the body of Jesus had been put in a tomb. And in the story, John wins the race and he reaches the tomb first and he peeks in, and Peter finishes in second place. But when he gets there, he goes right into the tomb and they find that the tomb is empty because Jesus has already been raised from the dead. And at the end of that race, they learn a lesson that's still true to this day. Here it is. It doesn't matter how fast you run to the tomb and how quickly you get there. What you find when you get there is that God has already done what needs to be done. Even before you knew it, the tomb was empty and God had already done the work that needed to be done. In the church, that's what we call prevenient grace. Now, the word prevenient literally means coming before or anticipatory. So prevenient grace is anticipatory grace. It's grace that anticipates our need for grace. It's the grace that God offers us before we even need it or before we know we need it. So in other words, prevenient grace is the reality that God makes the first move in your story. God doesn't wait for you to figure it out, doesn't wait for you to get it right. God doesn't wait on you to make a move. God already makes the first move, already made the first move, and that's prevenient grace. And that's one of the most important lessons that Jesus is trying to teach when he tells the story of what might be the most amazing running moment in history. A story in Luke 15 about a son who strikes out on his own and a father who waits for him to return. If you turn to Luke 15, we've been tracking through this story of what's often called the parable of the prodigal son over these last few weeks. And as we've followed this story, we've seen that the son has several awakenings that lead him on a path back toward home. So the first awakening is one that we all have. It's what we might call an awakening to longing. So in the story, the son looks around like so many of us have done. And he essentially says, there's got to be more to life than this. And then he goes to his father and he says, I want my inheritance now. I want to figure this out on my own. And the truth is, we all have this God-given longing to love and to be loved in return. We've all got this God-given longing to find a purpose for our life that gives us a reason to get up in the morning and to look forward to the day ahead. We've all got this God-given longing to make sense out of life when life doesn't make sense. And all of these longings that we have, the longings that the son in the story had, they are God-given longings. And they can either draw us toward God or they can send us away from God, all depending on what we do to try to fulfill the longings that we have. So the son in the story, he goes off and he blows all the money from his father in wild living. And he ends up losing everything. And then when Jesus says he has a when he came to his senses kind of moment, and in that moment, he has the second awakening, the awakening to regret. So he thinks to himself what a lot of us have thought to ourselves, which is, hey, what I'm doing here isn't working. Which leads him to the third awakening that we looked at last week, the awakening to help. And in this awakening, the son decides to return back home. He realizes that he can't do it on his own. He starts to come to grips with the fact that maybe he can't find what he's looking for without his father. And he decides to make a change. I want you to remember that you can do that, right? You can make a decision to change. Contrary to what you've been told, it actually doesn't have to stay the way it is. People say it is what it is, but the story of God and Jesus is actually, it's not what it is. It doesn't have to be what it is. So whatever it is in your life, it actually doesn't have to be the way it's always been. You're never too far gone for God. You can always make a decision to change. And so the son sets back toward home. He rehearses this speech that he wants to give to his father. It's, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So he sets off back toward home. We don't know how long it takes him to get home. The story doesn't say. Does he have to walk for a week? Does he have to walk for a month? We don't know. But I imagine that he rehearses that speech over and over and over again. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. He just repeats it over and over. You ever just rehearse a conversation like that in your head or out loud? Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. No. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I remember the drive to ask Amanda's dad for his blessing to marry his daughter. It was like, I love your daughter. No. I love your daughter. No, I love your daughter. I love your, I don't know which word to emphasize here. But as he approaches, he begins to get a pit in his stomach. Because he knows what's actually likely to happen. You see, in that culture, when someone in the community did something disgraceful, if they squandered their wealth with outsiders, when and if they tried to come back into the community, they'd be intercepted at the town gates by the elders or the leaders of the town, and the leaders would perform a ceremony called the kazaza. And kazaza literally means cut off. And this is how the ceremony would go. It would go something like this. They wouldn't let him back into the village. They'd stop him outside the gates and they would take a clay pot and they would smash the pot in front of the boy and they'd say something like this, you have broken our community and you are now cut off from us and you can never return. So that's what the son is expecting to happen. He's expecting to be cut off from the community. He's expecting the contempt of his father. But instead we see one of the greatest moments in running history. Jesus tells us that as the son walked toward home, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He wasn't filled with contempt for his son. He was filled with compassion for him. That same thing is still true of us today, right? When God sees you, it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter where you've been. It doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter what you've left undone. God is filled with compassion for you, not with contempt for you. Listen, that doesn't mean that you haven't made mistakes. It doesn't mean that your mistakes aren't real, or it doesn't mean that your sin isn't real. It doesn't mean that you don't need to change. It just means that God sees you first through a lens of love and compassion, not a filter of judgment and contempt. And so then Jesus says what would have been seen as one of the craziest things that Jesus ever said. That the father ran to his son, put his arms around him, and kissed him. You see, in the first century in the Middle East, fathers didn't run. It was incredibly undignified for a father to run. He would have had to hike up his garment and expose his legs to run, and it would have been humiliating for a father to run like that. It's humiliating for some of us who are fathers to run now, but it was especially humiliating in the first century because important people didn't run. Important people waited on other people to come to them and not the other way around. So the son was expecting kazaza. He was expecting condemnation. He was expecting judgment. He was expecting to have to earn his way back into the house. And instead, he was met with prevenient grace, anticipatory grace. He was met with a father who was already waiting and ready for his son, a father who made the first move. God always makes the first move. And so the son said to him, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But while the son was still speaking, the father shouts to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and put sandals on his feet." You see, in that culture, the robe was a symbol of rest. So at the father's command, the servants bring the best robe and they put it on the son. The best robe in the house is, of course, it's the father's robe. The father doesn't just give him an old robe or an extra robe that he's got in the closet. He gives his son his own robe. And when he gives his son his best robe, he's saying, "You don't have to run anymore. You don't have to prove yourself anymore. You don't have to keep trying to earn my approval anymore." And then there's the ring. The ring was a symbol of security. So throughout history, if you were in the presence of a king, you would kiss his ring because the king's ring was symbolic of his power. So presenting a ring to someone was a sign of being placed in an office of authority. So when the father gave his son his ring, he's transferring his power and his authority to his son. This son who was broke and penniless, the son who had wasted everything he'd ever been given, now had the father's financial identity and he could leverage it as his own. And in that moment, the son knew he would never go without a meal again. He knew he would never be without a place to sleep again. The ring sealed his identity as a child of his father and it gave him security. And then the sandals. The sandals were a symbol of acceptance. And so in an ancient Jewish home, the only people who would wear sandals in the house were the homeowners. The son probably returned home shoeless. He came home destitute. He came home looking more like a servant than a son. And so when the father gave him sandals, he was saying, "Welcome home. You're not a servant. You're my son. You're my family." And in that moment, the son had his fourth awakening, the awakening to love. When we awaken to the love of God, we come to live in the reality that our true identity is a son or a daughter of a heavenly father who loves us more than we could ever imagine. The author Brennan Manning says it this way. He says, "Define yourself radically as one who's beloved by God. This is the true self. Every other identity is illusion. God's love for you and his choice of you constitute your worth. Accept that and let it become the most important thing in your life." The prayer of the fourth awakening is this: "God, if you are real, make yourself real to me. Awaken in me the awareness that I am your unconditionally loved child." And then I love what happens next. As somebody who really enjoys smoked meat and a good party, I absolutely love this part of the story, starting in verse 23. The father says, bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and he's alive again. He was lost and now he's found. And so they began to celebrate. Now, don't miss this detail. The calf was already a fattened calf. So most cattle in that time, they just kind of roamed around in the fields. But if you were getting ready to host a big celebration, you'd put one of them in a stall and you'd feed it extra for several weeks. And the combination of extra food and limited movement would help it go from a lean calf or a regular calf to a fattened calf. Why was there already a fattened calf? Why didn't the father say, hey, let's fatten up a calf and in a few weeks we'll throw a party once the calf is adequately fattened? It's because the father had already anticipated that his son was coming back home. He was already ready. He was waiting. He was making all of the preparations in advance of his son coming back home. Right? This is not a story about everything that we need to do in order to get back home to God. This whole story is about the fact that God always makes the first move. God has already done the work that needs to be done in your life. Before you even knew that you needed there to be an empty tomb, the stone was rolled away from the entrance. Before you even looked around and said to yourself, this isn't working and I need a savior, before you could even make the turn and start walking down the driveway, God had already done the most amazing run in history.